This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm and a live link at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm. And also, you can send emails to comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here today as well. And we were talking a little baseball earlier. World Series started last night. The hottest, I think it might be the hottest one ever, certainly in recent years. It was just over 100 degrees at game time.
Yeah, they were showing a graphic, and apparently the recent game ones of the World Series in Boston and Kansas City and these other places were in the 50s or 60s, and here this game was at 103 degrees, so they were definitely smoking up there last night.
It's pretty hot for this time of year, so it's global warming. But pretty warm.
I was there in June at that ballpark, and it wasn't nearly that hot. It was like in the 70s, and now nearly November, and it's over 100 degrees.
Yeah, crazy. Crazy heat out there. Actually, I saw something the other day saying they had to cancel school in some of those areas. I don't know if they're just not equipped for the heat, but definitely a heat wave out there in Southern California. We were talking yesterday a little bit about the fact that you were on a pretty big trip and had traveled around a lot. And for those that do travel occasionally, you know that airports are something you have to deal with on some level usually. And you always hope your bag gets to its location, as it should. And you have to trust that people will do their job. And most times they do, but sometimes they don't. There was a baggage handler in the Singapore International Airport, and he was charged with 286 counts of mischief because he switched the tags on the bags.
I saw that.
Did you?
I couldn't believe that. I've always wondered about how people could really cause a lot of problems and chaos if they wanted to in a job like that, because it's not hard to switch bag tags. It's not. I don't know the purpose for something like that, but if you just wanted to pull a prank, you could mess up a lot of people's lives for quite a while.
Yeah, I don't know what the point of that would be other than to just cause mischief, like it says. So I don't know what the penalty
of mischief.
I don't know what the penalty for mischief is, but he's going to get a lot of he's going to get 286 counts of it. So I don't know. That's terrible. I actually, where I was sitting on a plane recently, I could see them taking the luggage off, and you know, they toss it. So you got to pack stuff well, knowing that those bags are going to go flying. Hey, there's my bag. And that guy just launched it into the cart. So pack the breakables very carefully.
Yeah, they are pretty rough with those bags sometimes. My briefcase has come out of those trips kind of scuffed up sometimes, and that's a little bit frustrating because it's a nice case, and you don't want to just have all these like scratches all over it, but I guess that's just the reality of the situation.
Yeah, they're moving bags all day, I guess. So I thought that was kind of a strange story. Mischief. 286 counts of mischief. A lot to talk about today, including what's on thetrumpet.com, preview of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and continuing to look at this great book, Russia and China in Prophecy. Before we get into that, here's one headline that is I guess, frustrating and just silly. I would say silly. Maybe that's not strong enough of a word. But this is from Fox News. White privilege bolstered by teaching math, a university professor says. So stay with me here. A math education professor at the University of Illinois says the ability to solve geometry and algebra problems and teaching such subjects perpetuates so-called white privilege. It doesn't add up. Ding, ding. Rochelle Gutierrez laid out her views on the subject in an article for a newly published anthology for math educators titled Building Support for Scholarly Practices in Mathematics Methods. Should have been called Why I Don't Like White People. School mathematics curricula emphasizing terms like Pythagorean theorem and pi perpetuate a perception that mathematics was largely developed by Greeks and other Europeans, she says. She also says that addressing equity in mathematics education will come when teachers can understand and negotiate the politics outside the classroom. She said, on many levels, mathematics itself operates as whiteness. Who gets credit for doing and developing mathematics? Who is capable in mathematics? and who is seen as part of the mathematical community is generally viewed as white, she writes. I don't see any proof of that, but she wrote it. Further, she says mathematics operates with unearned privilege in society just like whiteness. So I know that that's kind of a movement, the white privilege, I guess. But you really have to stretch and strain and do some real logical gymnastics here to try to get math in the mix. Math is about the most fair subject there could be. 1 + 1 is always 2. It doesn't discriminate. It's math, and it's just unbelievable that they're trying to push their political ideologies into something like algebra or geometry.
And who cares who came up with math? If it's a good thing and it has helped the world as much as it has, why does it matter the race or the gender or the ethnicity or the nationality of the person who did it? It's just so irrelevant, and yet that's what cultural Marxism is, where you try to divide people into groups and sort of just try to twist people's thinking into believing that your race can actually determine your mental acuity or your ability to move forward in society. And truly, it has nothing to do with that. America is the best example of this, that any person of any background, of any color, of any gender can move up the ladder and be successful. There are examples of all types of people being successful in this country. If you are a certain race, you don't just automatically have an advantage.
And two, aren't the math scores showing that typically the Asian nations do some of the best mathematical work? So I don't know how any of this adds up. And even with that, I think a lot of it might just be that they work harder at it. It's work ethic, mm-hmm. more than, say, some sort of just natural ability. But you know, there could be some natural ability. I don't know. But anyway, it's just it's amazing how these political movements and ideologies and social ones, I guess, as well, push their way into every facet of education today. You would think mathematics would be sort of untouchable when it comes to politics or social agendas, but they're trying to jam it all together there. So just strange. I don't think there's any way you can make this work logically, what she's saying.
Not at all. And you do bring out a strong point as well about Asians being generally better at math. I mean, if you have those contests between nations to see who does the best on these math tests, America is not even in the top, like, 30, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure they might even be dipping down toward 100 in some subjects. And that clearly, I mean, it's so obviously that is because of work ethic. It's because of the way that the children are raised to work hard over in a lot of those Asian nations, and even the Asian immigrants to this country and other countries. They have a different culture and something that we could really learn from as other races. Just the fact that they work hard and they discipline their children, and their children develop a lot of talents and a lot of skills. Instead of criticizing whites who aren't even the best at math, why not learn from the Asians who are the best at math instead of just being jealous of them?
Yeah, I'm white, full disclosure, and math was not my strong suit. I wish I was privileged in math, but it was always a little more of a effort for me. But we're living. I mean, I think we could honestly say this is just sort of evil thinking. It is evil thinking.
It is.
Because it is racist and it is divisive. But if you wanted to take it maybe a little more on a different path, you could say, if nothing else, it's silly. It's mm-hmm. just silliness. To if you're going to add to some sort of anthology for math educators and have something of value to put in there, this is just silly. You might as well just say, I don't know. You know, you can make up anything. You could say that, well, it affects people that struggle with eating because it's called pie. you might as well say something like that. I can't stop thinking about
it. We're not far off from literally hearing that argument, I'm sure. I mean, we've just gone into this realm of total unreality, just absolute absurdity these days. Those arguments are just, like you said, they are evil. I mean, to say that a certain race, just by virtue of being that color, automatically has an advantage, or, you know, historically receives all the credit for a certain achievement, is ridiculous. I mean, I think there are incredible achievements from all cultures and races, and the fact that they are a certain race has very little to do with it. It's all about the culture. What did the culture produce? And sure, maybe there are certain races within that culture, but there are great cultures of all races. The race part of it has nothing to do with it. The culture, the upbringing, the background, the environment of people is what makes them who they are and determines their success. The race has nothing to do with it, although, especially in this country, the last 8 years, we were conditioned to think that race had a big part to play. You know, statements like white people are racist because it's in their DNA. You do start to think, well, maybe it is because of my color that I am this way, when truly, if we just took a second to think about it, we would know that's not true at all.
Yeah, and if you look to the Bible, which we need to do, you know, God created all man, all mankind, all people, and math, too, by the way. And Satan's the divider. Mm-hmm. So when you look at divisive rhetoric, you know where it's coming from. Speaking of math, Einstein was pretty good at math, from what I recall. And a kind of a neat little story about him today. He was on a trip years ago, obviously, when he was still alive. And he wanted to give a tip, and I think the person didn't want a tip from him. So he wrote two little notes in place of the tip, because he knew, I mean, he had just won the Nobel Prize, so he knew that he was going to, you know, have some fame, I guess. And he said, you know, look, this will probably be worth more than the tip, so I'll write you a couple of notes. So and they just sold for like $1 million, but that's not the interesting part. I think the interesting part is what he said on them. And he wrote his theory for happiness. He said, he wrote, "A calm and modest life brings more happiness than the pursuit of success combined with constant restlessness." Mm. Interesting thought from Einstein.
Yeah, you could definitely apply that today, not to discount the importance of pursuing success, but still, when that is combined with stepping on the neck of other people and trampling others and being unethical, and like we see today, constantly lying about your opposition, then we've taken the pursuit of success too far.
Yeah, I mean, even if just tying back to this first story about the whiteness of math or whatever, you know, the people that are believing that idea, or this lady that wrote it, this teacher, she's got constant restlessness. You can tell she's not content. She's not happy. That's not a happy way to think or go about life. And so the calm and modest life, he said, brings more happiness than the pursuit of success combined with constant restlessness. And I think that's the point. Not that you shouldn't be successful, but just that restlessness and that constantly trying to, you know, not have a peace of mind and a contentedness. Then another one he wrote, very famous saying, where there's a will, there's a way. So he wrote that too.
That also applies.
It does.
Because instead of attributing whether or not we're good at something to our race, why not just put some will into it? Why not work hard at something and see what happens? I mean, I feel like every single person could easily achieve so much more. I mean, think if people put the energy that they spend complaining about things like that into actually learning math, how much better would they be at math? And how much more could they prove that it's not all about your race? And it is quite a paradox, isn't it, that these people are professional complainers. That's what they do every single day. They stir up hatred and yet call people who oppose them hateful. They could be doing some pretty incredible things with all that energy that they spend on non-productive purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have students in a classroom or your own children or something, it's a great disservice to say to them, well, you can't succeed at this and it's everybody else's fault. As opposed to saying, well, why don't you try a little harder? I bet you could do more than you think. Mm-hmm. And don't worry about what the critics say.
Well, isn't that woman who is criticizing math a university professor?
Yes.
She's pretty prominent. She has a lot of influence on young minds. And she's not the only one teaching things like that. That's the problem today, is that our universities are so far left, and they do teach our students that they are perfect the way they are. If the world does not bend to their will, it's actually the world's fault. It's not the fault of these young people for failing to adapt. It's everybody else's fault except for the people who are actually failing.
Yeah, it would be something, wouldn't it? You get a math test back and you did poorly on it, and they just write like, well, it was everybody else's fault. I always got it with, you know, grade that maybe I didn't like, but I think it was my fault.
Yeah, there's really almost no way to blame other people for things like that, and yet we're finding that some people get pretty creative with blaming others and never, ever taking responsibility. And that gets old. I mean, people get tired of hearing the complaining, especially when it comes from a university professor. How much more privileged, I don't know what her race is, but she's privileged regardless of the race, and yet she's complaining. Yeah. What's so bad anyway about being privileged? She obviously worked to get in the position she's in. No, I don't have any problem with someone being privileged, but then to turn around and complain that she automatically has a disadvantage despite being a highly paid university professor, that's where it gets to be a bit too much.
It's I think it's that restlessness that Einstein was talking about, because sometimes there are different university professors that aren't content to teach the subject. They want to branch out and get a little more notoriety, and I think this is maybe what this is, where if you can come up with this big theory that really blows people away outside of the normal math realm, then you know, you get more notoriety. So I don't know if that's the cause behind it, but it doesn't have a lot to do with math, that's for sure. That's you can read the rest of that at Fox if you want. White privilege bolstered by teaching math, university professor says.
And it does really seem like I said, it's like the most wealthy and the most blessed people are the most ungrateful now. And there was an example on that on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News. He had some university professor who came on there and was saying, well, you don't know about police brutality because you're not black like I am. And actually, we're living two different lives in the same country. And Tucker Carlson asked him, well, what neighborhood are you from? I mean, you're wearing $1,000 cufflinks. You're obviously doing very well for yourself. And the guy's like, yeah, but no one of any other race has ever experienced the type of brutality we have. And it's just, this is just a myth that's being perpetuated. It's just a way of getting people stirred up emotionally. Why is that person ranting about that when clearly he is more blessed than 99% of the people watching the show?
Yeah, it's it gets to be pretty it would be a very difficult thing if every human being lined up and started, you know, compared notes on life and well, who's fair, what wasn't fair, this wasn't fair, you know, I mean, everybody's got their ups and downs, you know, and so and then what do you do? What do you do? How do you make it right? You know, just very, very divisive thinking there, like you said.
Yeah, whether it's being supposedly mistreated by the police or not getting a fair grade on a test, if we think that happened. I mean, it doesn't matter what the race is. Different people go through different problems, and we have different experiences. Everyone has trials to go through, and to pretend like it's all limited to one race and that only one small group of people is being oppressed while everyone else has it perfect, that's just not reality.
Yeah, I guess if people are trying to be more divisive, they're looking at the differences, which differences aren't bad necessarily, but if you look at what we have in common, is we're all human. Mm-hmm. We're all made in the image and the likeness of God, and that's the starting point for getting along, and then looking at the laws that govern all human beings. They govern no matter what race you are. There's 10 commandments, mm-hmm. and that's, of course, what we need to get back to, but you don't see that today.
What about in this nation? We're all supposed to be Americans, right? And so it used to be that no matter how different our backgrounds were, we could all at least unite around the flag and the national anthem. And now even those symbols are being torn down. So it's like pretty much the only thing we had that we all had in common is being taken away from us now too. You can just see the radical left at work, just trying to tear down every pillar of society to where we literally have nothing left in common. So then at that point, it's a struggle for supremacy.
Yeah, lots of division being stirred up. Also, this relates to the, in a way, to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host Stephen Fleury coming up here in a bit. Is there Russian collusion? Yeah, there is, and it turns out it involves Hillary Clinton and the DNC. Talks a fair bit about that. I mean, it's all over the news, even though I don't think they want to report it. I think it's so blatant now they kind of have to. Clinton campaign, DNC helped pay for work on the dossier about Russia and Trump. So lo and behold, they're involved there. And there's a lot more that is brought out on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show about a lot of business deals with Russia and with the Clinton Foundation and the money that went back and forth, and on and on and on it goes. So it's amazing how quick they were to point the finger at the other side and accuse them of what they were doing from the DNC's perspective. So from where they were, they were pointing the finger, but it was what they were involved in. So who knows? I mean, there's probably collusion all over, but as is brought out on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, it'll be interesting to see how the media handles this.
Mm-hmm.
If they just kind of give it the obligatory headline and then move on, which, you know, in the words of Mrs. Clinton, you know, what difference does it make at this point? So anyway, it's a very sticky situation.
Well, you do have to think about the fact that for decades the left in this country was too soft on Russia, and then for the past year, all of a sudden, despite zero evidence, they have accused Russia of totally flipping the U.S. election last November. Now here's a story with 100 times more evidence, actually infinity times more evidence, because there's still zero evidence of the other story, and you know the media is not going to cover it. It just is an absolute disgrace how far the media in this country has fallen. They actually used to do a job, even if they might have had their own personal biases. They still at least tried to uphold some sort of journalistic integrity. Now that's completely gone. I actually saw a video of a conservative podcaster, and he spent weeks or maybe even months infiltrating Antifa, and he just wanted to expose how they truly are a violent movement. They do plan attacks at these different conservative speaking events. And yet the media, obviously, they just talk about them as counter-protesters, that they have peaceful motives. He infiltrated them. He saw them passing out knives and talking about how there was a car park down the street full of guns, if it got real, if they really needed the guns. And so it's as blatant as it gets that they're planning literal violent attacks on people who they disagree with and they falsely call fascists. He immediately went and he showed that footage to the police. The police made some preemptive arrests before they were able to carry out their plan. He then went and showed it to local and national media, and they both were like, oh, well, you know, have a nice day, and they walked off.
Hmm.
They would not report on it. That is a huge story, but because it doesn't back the left's ideology, because it makes the left look like it is violent and psychopathic, which it has turned into lately, they're not going to report on it. It just shows you how corrupt the media is, and you know this is going to be another situation here with the Russia collusion with the Democrats. They're not going to report on it because it doesn't match their ideology.
It's going to be interesting to see how it goes. I think Washington Post sends out their daily headlines, and I got that email, and I was curious to see what they would say about it. And they have it there, but it's the second story. There's a massive one about, you know, anti-Trump, and then there's a right below it. It's like, well, you know,
it could be the biggest scandal in American history, bigger than the Watergate supposed scandal that they talk constantly about to this day, and they name everything after. But it doesn't even warrant the top section on a weekly email, apparently, yeah. if the media is to be believed.
Isn't the whole idea of collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign go back to the debate when they were talking about Hillary Clinton's hacked emails, and somebody said maybe Russia did it, and he's like, well, I hope they did it. Isn't that, I don't know if that's exactly where they got the idea from, but it seems like after that, then the media is like, oh, yeah, they're working with Russia.
Yeah, I know for sure he either said that at a debate or directly in between two debates, and they seized on that as if he was a pawn of Vladimir Putin, even though basically all he was saying was he hopes that the truth comes to light no matter how it does. Because you know there's a lot of filth hidden in American politics. Regardless of who exposes it, it is nice to have it exposed.
Yeah, it seems like all the stones that are getting turned over now, you just see all the grimy things underneath, the creepy crawlies, whether it be what's going on, say, with the DNC or what's happened with Hollywood lately. You know, you start kicking a few stones over and it's not a good picture underneath it. But the main point of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show that's brought out is that the solution to the world's problems cannot come from the government of man. I mean, you can look at You can look left, you can look right, you can look wherever, but there's just ongoing problems, and the government of man is not able to solve it. And of course, it's God's government that has to solve it. And we're being allowed, you know, to go on long enough here before Christ does intervene to kind of try out about every personality, every ideology, every way of thinking, and none of it works. It just blows up on itself.
It does appear we've tried out every last possible way of governing ourselves, every possible political ideology to either extreme and anywhere in the middle, and none of it works. And that's just something that we're going to have to learn. We've been learning it for 6,000 years of our existence, and yet we have to learn it even more severely for us to finally let that set in.
Yeah, it's all kinds of ideas. And then old and tired ideas keep coming back again, too. You know,
the ones that haven't worked, that have been proven to be failures repeatedly.
Yeah, let's try it again. tying into that is something that happened on this day in history. 1917 on this day, the Bolsheviks, or the communists, under Vladimir Lenin, seized power in Russia. Not a good time in Russia. That was 1917. After World War I, Lenin was welcomed back to Russia. He'd been exiled for a while in Europe. And he was supported by other radical thinkers, and he led the Bolsheviks in the bloody, violent Red October Revolution. Lenin, much to his own surprise, effectively ended the Russian Empire rather easily and established the Soviet state that would soon become a global superpower. It says the masses loved him, and he had won their full support and devotion with his speeches and illegal writings calling for a change. So they liked him when he was a revolutionary, and he promised a lot of things. In the following almost 3 years of civil war, the Bolsheviks assumed total control of the country. And Lenin proved, though, once he came into power, to be decisive and ruthless from the very beginning. He neglected his fellow countrymen, sufferings, and mercilessly crushed any opposition or riots. Isn't that the way it is with human leaders? They come in promising equality and fairness, and then they crush the opposition.
Yeah, especially with communism, because communism can sound good, especially to those at the bottom of the social structure, those who have the hardest, lowest paying jobs. It can sound nice to have everyone on the same level and maybe have them raised up. But then after a while, you realize, well, there's only a certain level I can reach. I can't climb to the top anymore. And everything I say could be used against me. The government is always listening, always watching. It's a police state. It's authoritarian. You could be thrown in prison for something that your relative said. I mean, it's a miserable way of life. And of course, they killed tens of millions of their own people in that Soviet state. It just shows you the desperate desire for power that I think we all probably have that somewhere under the surface if we don't, and it could come out if we're not careful. Anyone who is in a position to take absolute control over a nation probably would do it and would probably do almost anything to keep it, and that's what you've seen in the Soviet state and in any of these other communist nations.
Yeah, and if you look historically the Bible, using the Daniel image of depicting the world ruling empires over the years, one of the things that is noted about that is that the metals, they were more precious at the top than they are at the bottom of the statue. So in other words, the governments years ago, the world ruling empires, they started out somewhat better, even though they weren't good. But there was more probably quality of character. The metals had more quality. They had more value. You get down to the 10 toes and you're dealing with steel and clay. I mean, iron and clay, rather. And so, you know, very hard, very rough, very crushing type metals. And if you look at the governments here, like, say, the Bolsheviks or the communists, I mean, they just crushed their own people. Mm-hmm. They were not leaders of quality or of character. They were just out to bludgeon the masses into obedience.
Well, doesn't that run absolutely counter to what we hear about human nature, how we're always getting better? We're always becoming more enlightened. We're always advancing as societies and moving forward in terms of picking leaders who will love us and serve us. What we've seen is some of the greatest atrocities in all of history taking place just in the last century. The leaders are not becoming more benevolent and more giving and merciful and caring. They're becoming the exact opposite. They're seizing power in ways that we've never even seen before. And so if time keeps going on like this and we're continued to be allowed to rule ourselves, you're just going to see it get even worse than Hitler, even worse than Stalin.
Yep. Matthew 24, what talks about what times will be like if Christ didn't, you know, and that he has to intervene. And if he didn't, there wouldn't be any flesh saved alive. That was talked about on the Trump Daily Radio Show yesterday a fair bit, too. In May 1922, Lenin suffered a stroke. There were a few assassination attempts that caused him some health problems. Never fully recovered from that one. He lost his power of speech, and his right arm and leg were paralyzed. In December, he had another stroke, and then the third followed in March 1923, and he turned him into a living corpse. Now he's a dead corpse, embalmed and placed in a mausoleum in the memoriam on Moscow's Red Square. So you can still see him there today, which is always a little bit, well, very creepy to me. I don't like that.
Well, it even seems like they're memorializing him in a good way. Mm-hmm. So it does tell you a lot about some of these Gentile nations and the people they look up to, the type of leaders they prefer. Despite the immense suffering inflicted on their own people, they like to be powerful. They like to look at these strong men in charge and basically do whatever they're told by those men.
Yep, very authoritative regimes. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that here and getting into Russia and China and prophecy. But on this day, 1917, the Bolsheviks, under Vladimir Lenin, known as the communists, of course, seize power in Russia. We're talking about Russia and China in prophecy this week. And today we're talking about the third chapter, what the China miracle means. China is growing by leaps and bounds, and you need to get this book at thetrumpet.com. It's free, and it's updated, so if you've read it before, it's good to get it again. It says, Russia knew exactly what it was doing by timing its invasion of Georgia for August 7th, 2008. It so happened that the world was engrossed in an apparently far more compelling drama at the time, the imminent start of the spectacular Olympic Games in Beijing. China used the occasion to announce itself to the world as a power, every bit as vibrant and muscular as the athletes it hosted, unabashedly confident, radiating with national pride, exploding into modernity. China, they're more modern is what it's saying. China is on fire. And I'm sure everybody remembers those Olympics from 2008. Those were spectacular. Mm-hmm. They had those remarkable venues, the Bird's Nest. Do you remember that? And the Water Cube. Yeah. They were amazing places to watch those games.
And like this chapter covers, they're able to pretty much erect structures like that overnight. And they're even high quality structures, but they just have so much manpower, so many resources, so much money to throw into these types of things that they are not the backward nation that many of us still think of them as. They have advanced so much in the last 30 years, even building 65,000 miles of road just in the last 30 years.
That's amazing.
They didn't have any roads before that, pretty much.
And you think about the way the infrastructure in the U.S. is really crumbling in a lot of cases, and even the most recent Olympics in Rio, it was kind of a debacle because it's just kind of a backwards area. But here China really did show. And then, you know, Russia showed with their Olympics, too. I mean, just it was pretty amazing. I still remember the Russian Olympics because they had the big teddy bear that cried at the end.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still awed by that. Like, that's all I remember about those Olympics. I don't remember. I think Michael Phelps won the medals, but I just remember the giant bear crying. I'm like, how did they do that?
What is it about the Olympics bring out the strangest, like, amorphous mascots you've ever seen? Every Olympics just brings out some sort of new freak show.
Yeah, it's probably a good description of Russia. Like, look at that giant cuddly bear, and then it rips your head off. You have to be careful. They are the lumbering bear. That's what they're known as. But anyway, that was a hugely successful Olympics there in China. And the book points out that you just have to look at the numbers. In one sense, it's a question of simple math. It's all about math today for us. China has 1.4 billion people. One out of every five people on Earth is amazing. That, you know, it's interesting, too. I was in Seattle recently, and we stopped at a shopping center. And there was a lot of people from Asia somewhere there, and they had a lot of signs for them and a lot of things. I've been to a few places like that where people are kind of traveling about, and a lot of it's catering to the Asians. But if you think about 1 in 5 people, that's probably a lot of who comes there, even in the United States.
Well, that's right. We get a ton of Asian tourists in this country, and it seems like they are pretty big parts of the tourism industry all over the world. It's not that maybe they all have a lot of money, but because there's so many people in those nations, of course they're going to be a large amount of the tourists. They're going to be a large amount of the travelers, and it's only smart to cater to them. We've obviously had the luxury of speaking English and being the primary international language, but you're going to probably see that change a lot just because of how many Asians there are on the planet.
Yeah. I can't read it. I can't read the tags.
No, I couldn't imagine trying to learn symbols instead of letters.
That'd be hard to do. But it points out here that, you know, 1 out of every 5 people on Earth is from China. That's America's population plus a billion. And so they say, well, now multiply any trend relating to society, economy, technology, food, or anything else, you know, by that 1.4 billion, and you will see a huge global impact. So just by the sheer numbers of the population, they're impacting the world. China uses about 60% of the world's cement. That's a lot of cement. From having no highways, like you said, just 30 years ago, to now, you know, all that they have. They have over 50,000 more cars every day.
What?
That's a lot. You know, you think about the rickshaws. 50,000 more cars every day, 21 million more per year. China will not only soon be the world's biggest market for new cars, but also its largest car maker. And it also consumes about half the world's iron and steel. As of 2005, China had 135 civil airports. By the end of 2016, the number had grown to 218. So they're just growing by leaps and bounds over there. And it's a miracle, as the book points out. I mean, if you look at the economic growth, you think, what? Look at how they're growing. Each year, they say almost 8 million Chinese move from the country to the city. This urban migration is driving the construction of equivalent of Chicago plus Detroit each year.
Wow.
Today, the United States has 10 cities of over 1 million people. China has more than 160 of them.
That's
amazing.
Stressful to think about.
Yeah.
Like how they can sustain that many people and provide for that many people in one nation. It does give me anxiety almost to think how China is able to survive.
Yeah. Well, you think about some of the big cities in the U.S., and there is growth and there is development, I'm sure, but a lot of the skylines haven't changed, you know, in my lifetime, not much. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same as it's been. You know, we still have a lot of past glory here in the U.S., but we haven't done a lot of development lately, not like China's done. And then you can look at, say, Detroit, which has been a good example recently of a bad example of falling apart. Lots of cities in the U.S. falling apart. Roads need repair. Airports are getting a little bit grimy. And we just don't see the development, certainly not on the level like China had. So just even looking at that, you can see China's on the rise, and the U.S. is stagnating at best and declining probably in reality.
Yeah, and this booklet does bring out a lot of reasons why that's the case, and part of it is just we have bureaucracy to try to wade through in this nation and other Western nations that slows us down. We have human rights issues that we worry about that China has no qualms about at all. We are hesitant to make trade deals with certain nations that have dictatorial, tyrannical regimes. China doesn't care about that. So really what they're doing is they're gobbling up the entire world, and they don't have really any ethical laws to slow them down.
Yeah, absolutely. The climate stuff, obviously, is...
Don't care about climate change.
No, they don't care about that. They're dropping cement everywhere. So they're growing quite a bit. They're described here in Russia and China Prophecy as the world's hungry teenager, which is a good description. If you've ever been a teenager, or you have had teenagers, which probably you'd qualify for both of those if that's the case, they can be hungry and want to eat a lot constantly. So that's what China is, and they're growing. Another point that's brought out here in this chapter is on January 16th, 2016, so about a year ago, it marked a radical turning point for the global economy. particularly America's economic dominance. On that date, at a lavish ceremony, President Xi officially launched the massive Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or the AIIB. It's a new Chinese-run international bank that directly challenges U.S. global economic leadership. The bank's official role is to help finance development of infrastructure in Asia, which, of course, is going to be a lot of business. It will facilitate the completion of energy and power projects, transportation and telecommunication networks, rural infrastructure and agricultural development, water supply and sanitation, utilities, and urban development and logistics programs. The goal of the AIIB is to become the premier source of development funding in Asia, which is the world's biggest market, I guess, at least at this time. Unofficially, the goal of the bank is to reduce Asian dependence on the American-controlled World Bank and replace it with dependence on China. And if you look at what they're really doing, ultimately they want to replace the U.S. dollar with the Chinese yuan, as the medium of finance. So the only thing really keeping us afloat in the U.S. amidst all of our rivers of debt is that the U.S. dollar is still the global currency. But if that we lose that, we're going to lose a lot.
Yeah, the development of that Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, like you said, last January 16, was pretty much overlooked because we had the implementation of the Iranian nuclear deal that same day. But the way that this investment bank is described, both of those things hugely undermine the U.S. Obviously, Iran getting nuclear weapons is bad for the entire world, but we're the ones being duped into that. And here, the entire goal of this bank is to replace the U.S. dollar and to reduce Asian independence on the American-controlled World Bank, as it says there. A lot of nations are hostile to the U.S. That's something we need to acknowledge. They are, like we said yesterday, sharks in the water just waiting for us to show enough weakness for them to take advantage. And this is just another example of that. People are tired of having to use the dollar as the reserve currency, having to rely on U.S. financial systems and support around the world. And so in any way that they possibly can, these nations are turning to China and other options for their alliances.
And it's something that I think, unless you're taking the time to stop and look at thetrumpet.com or read The Trumpet or get this book on Russia and China and prophecy, you don't hear a whole lot about this bank or what China's doing. Maybe people that are really, really into like investments and things and the global financial market, maybe they would be more aware. But, you know, you just get this sense that the bottom can be taken out of the U.S. economy very quickly and people would just be stunned by it, you know, the casual observer, mm-hmm. and say, well, what happened? You know, I thought things were going to go on as normal. And then all of a sudden the world's changed. And so that's why it's so important to keep up with things here in books like this.
Yeah, that is a wonderful point, just the fact that so many news outlets don't cover it. And, of course, the reason The Trumpet covers it is because it is prophetically significant, talking about the kings of the East. If you don't have that proper looking glass through which to examine the world, the light of Bible prophecy like we have at thetrumpet.com, it does get a lot harder to decide which news is important. You wouldn't think that China's that important unless you knew what the prophecies say about it.
Right. It's and like you pointed out, the Iranian nuclear deal was taking all the headlines, which that was a huge, huge thing as well. So, I mean, but this Chinese investment bank is a big deal. So there's more details about that in this book. It also points out in this chapter how Taiwan and China are growing closer. You know, when we talk about Russia and China and prophecy, it does include those other nations that are near there. You know, because the Bible talks about a 200 million man army, and you have to start looking at where those population centers come from, and that's where you find them. They're in there. So they get into a lot more details about that in the chapter. And one other thing I wanted to point out from the chapter, too, and again, we're just hitting the high spots, so you're going to want to go back and read this, but is the military rise of China. They've been very aggressive militarily as well. It says, to add teeth to its aggressive economic and political policies, China is working diligently to upgrade its military capabilities. In 2008, China overtook the United Kingdom as the world's second largest military spender. Though far behind America's $607 billion of military spending, China is quickly closing the gap. In 2014, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute estimated that China spent $216 billion on its military. The People's Liberation Army is the largest standing army in the world with 2.3 million troops, and China has 318 million men fit for military service. That's a lot.
That's the population of our country, yeah. Almost. It's like 10 million off.
I know, and it's unbelievable. The PLA ground force contains 1.6 million men. Experts say this number can be quickly augmented by an 800,000-strong reserve force, 1.5 million armed police, and 8 million militiamen. They have incredible numbers, you know, and it's. I'm sure the military in the U.S. kind of looks at that. They'd have to kind of pay attention. But you just start looking at the numbers of just people. Just that alone is something, but of course they've been behind with their technology, but they're catching up quickly. And then if you think about what they've been doing in the South China Sea, you know, they're building islands, then they just take over the sea, and no one's really going to stand up to them. And they've got North Korea there, you know, rattling the cage just to get everybody upset while they continue to build their massive empire.
Yeah, and the end of this chapter in the booklet does talk about their island building, how aggressive they've been, building islands 800 miles off the coast of China, but only 150 miles off the coast of the Philippines. So obviously way closer to the Philippines, and yet they're going to claim that land as well. But what this booklet talks about is how wise they've been diplomatically, trying to make relations with these nations. The investment bank that we talked about was a big part of that, where they were able to sway even some of the U.S. allies away from America's World Bank over to the Chinese investment bank. And by doing that, they softened a lot of those nations up, and now the Philippines doesn't have as much of a problem as they used to with the island building. Some of these nations are realizing that America doesn't keep its promises. And we talked about that yesterday, even with Russia, and how they felt betrayed by the way we assisted Germany in the Balkans. And so they felt justified in going into Georgia, going into the Ukraine. And although our politicians spoke strongly against those invasions, they didn't do anything about it. That's what it gets down to. And nations like China see the same thing. America's allies see the same thing. Taiwan, which has long struggled with China, sees that. And yet they don't feel like America's going to be reliable if China ever decides to invade and take them over. So why not, if you're the leader of one of those nations, just get in line with China and hope that they won't attack you? And China has been good diplomatically. Like I said, they have been building around the world. They've been throwing their resources and their manpower into projects around the world. And at the same time, like this booklet brings out, they haven't been asking for anything in return immediately. Maybe down the road they'll ask for a favor, but what they're doing is laying the groundwork for a lot of beneficial friendships, whether now or in the future.
Right. If you are a smaller nation like a Philippines or a Taiwan or something, you want to be on the good side of whoever runs the block.
Yeah.
And more that's getting to be China along with Russia. And like you said, the U.S. has been very, they've betrayed their allies in a lot of cases. And now with the political turmoil in this country, I would think that foreign nations wouldn't even be sure of what the next administration will do, whoever it is, because it used to be that no matter what party came into power, we kind of kept the same basic foreign relations, policies. And now that you don't know one administration to the next, so it's getting pretty nerve-wracking for allies of the U.S.
Yeah, that's true. If we saw a fundamental change in American foreign policy under the last administration, and how they did seem to constantly be elevating their allies or elevating their enemies and debasing their allies, that is going to be obviously different from the way Mr. Trump is going to try to handle things. Yet the precedent is set. Anytime another Democrat is in office, probably that person's going to follow in the footsteps of President Obama. So after spending 4 or 8 years building up our allies, who knows, maybe the next administration would start tearing them down again. I mean, those are just facts. That's what had happened under the last administration. And compared to what's happening now, it's very different. We don't have a coherent foreign policy anymore because the two parties in this country are so divided that our priorities in every single area, whether it's socially, domestically, culturally, internationally, they're just totally different. It's going to be totally different, and all these nations can't depend on us. We're weak, we're crippled by division, and we don't seem to want to keep our promises like we've been talking about. And of course, that's going to enrage a lot of nations and fill them with fear. And out of fear, they're going to turn in desperation to nations like China.
Yeah, the more and more authoritarian governments are moving forward without all the infighting of their peoples. Not that those are good governments, but they're able to get some things done, I guess, when they need to. Another thing mentioned in the booklet we don't have time to get into, but is the rise of Russia and China, how that's provoking Europe to be more combative as well. Just finally says here, the rise in cooperation of Russia and China that we are witnessing is prophecy being fulfilled. For not only is it certain to provoke Europe to assume a far more combative posture in securing its much-needed resources, but these Asian nations have a significant role to play in the events prophesied to unfold shortly. And so it goes through a lot of those scriptures in this chapter. We don't have time to get into that, but you can look those up and need to. It says, keep your eye on China. Within a few short years, this nation, the ascendant proud China that has emerged today, will dazzle the world. Watching its vault into great power status truly is a look at the future. And so really, really interesting and important chapter there in Russia and China prophecy. It's the third chapter, What the China Miracle Means. And recommend you get that book and read it there at thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dwight Falk and Grant Turgeon. Thanks for being with us today. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.